he says you could blind, you know, he could get students blindfolded and they'd feel like confident that they could run across the road and not get hit by a car. And I think that's carried through with him. That
what, what is that quote? That is the worst quote of all time.
Bird Box Golf.
My boy Paul Casey goes back-to-back at the Valspar Invitational. Robert Garrigus gets suspended. Roy McIlroy to play the Canadian Open. And Patrick Reed's wife calls David Ledbetter to fix her husband's swing. We got a lot to get into this week. Welcome to Episode 7 of the Flagstick.com T-Talk Podcast. My name is Stefan Tiedorf. Sitting across from me in studio, as always, is the Associate Publisher of Flagstick and a PGA of Canada professional, Scott McLeod. How are you today, buddy?
I'm doing great, bud. How are you?
I am horrible.
You are not looking well.
I'm in a blanket cocoon. You can probably see it on Nick's Instagram at some point. And I'm struggling. I got a long week of work, too. So
you are a trooper. We'll give you that.
We're calling it the Michael Jordan flu game. It's pretty much the same thing.
Lovely.
Right?
Pass it around.
Yeah. Have fun, boys. I'm going away for work. I don't have to listen to you. As per usual, we are joined by our producer, Nick Gallinger. How are you, buddy?
I'm great.
Good. Good. That's it.
Looking forward to being sick?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be sick after this one.
Yeah. Oh, not
it's
so
a grind.
Good.
I apologize ahead of time, boys, but we got a lot to get into, and we can't cancel it this week. Our listeners are waiting for this. As I mentioned off the top, Paul Casey went back-to-back at the Valspar Invitational. Scotty, how much do you love the Snake Pit? I know you're big into names on golf courses.
Oh, I just hate it, but I love the golf course.
It looks awesome.
It's an awesome golf course.
You've played it before, right?
No, I've just been there a few times, so it's a hard golf course. I mean, there's just nowhere to hit it. There's water or woods. Or a slim bit of fairway.
And a rock hard, like, greens. Like, the guys were hitting it, and they're rolling out with wedge. It was nuts. It was something different, for sure. I saw one player on tour said, yeah, Paul Casey hit it into about 4 yards that he could on that fairway there. It just looks like a tight golf course, a hard golf course. But it's kind of different. It's nice to see guys. We don't need to see guys not making birdies like at the U.S. Open, but this was definitely a tough one that, you know, other players could relate to.
Yeah, I mean, pars are at a premium there. You don't see a ton of birdies. You certainly see your share of bogeys, which is sort of relatable for
Dustin Johnson on final day.
Yeah, even Paul Casey on 17. I mean, obviously, it made the tournament a little bit more dramatic. He makes a bogey there and then, you know, puts one in the bunker and he's got to hit his approach out of there and make par. So it's, it's a tough golf course and certainly getting these guys ready for big events that are coming up.
A little bit easier to hit it out of that fairway bunker with the forearms that he has. Eh? You can just power one through.
He was only 125 yards out, though. And, you know, they make it out like he's 200 yards out and he's hitting a fairway wood. Yeah. You know, he's got a pitching wedge in his hand. So, yeah. But anyways.
He's had quite the career, Paul Casey. He's made now over $30 million on tour. What do you think about him for the Masters this year?
I love him for the Masters.
I saw a bet at like 55-1 and I almost took it, and then I think I passed out because I was sick, but I agree with you. I love him for the Masters.
Look, he hits it, you know, right to left. He putts well. He's got a great short game. He stays calm. He's got a really good attitude right now, and the fact that, you know, he won a year ago and wins again, his game is sort of reborn a little bit. He's got confidence heading into the Masters, which is only a couple weeks away. There'd be a lot worse players to bet on at this point. That's for sure.
You're gonna get you're gonna get some good odds on it. I'm probably gonna sprinkle a little. Maybe, I don't know. Am I allowed to bet on golf?
Why not?
Oh, sure. Cool. There's a couple other guys out there this week that some good stories. Jason Kokrak. This guy, he's been on tour since 2012. He's made over $10 million. He's only at 2 second places. This could have been his big break, and again, another second place. What do you know about Jason Kokrak?
Well, the biggest thing that a lot of people don't realize is that he's actually born in Canada. So you didn't even know that, did you?
Did not know that.
Yeah,
no.
So he's actually born in North Bay, Ontario.
Lovely. Yeah. Lovely this
lovely
time
North
of year.
Bay. Yeah. Exactly. And so his mom was from there, and she would happen to be visiting her parents, and she had him early, but he was raised in Ohio. And never took his Canadian citizenship, so we can't really claim him.
I was going to claim him.
But he hits it. He hits it really hard. So.
It like just crushes down on it.
He's a big boy.
Yes.
Really moves it out there, which is really interesting when you think about that, playing this golf course that, you know, we're talking about being tight and narrow and, you know, very demanding. He's not the guy you would think of that's, you know, he's not Mo Norman striping it down the middle of the fairways all the time, but he was able to take advantage of the golf course. As you said, hasn't got a win yet on tour, but looks like a guy who will eventually, you know, maybe break through. You never know. Could be just a career journeyman, but He's made some good cheese since 2012. So
I'd take 10 mil yeah, across.
I'm sure he's happy.
Years,
I'm sure he's happy that way. So it was nice. It was nice to see him in the mix. And you know, it could have been a more dramatic tournament though, because obviously we had some other big names that were in the mix for a while. Mm-hmm.
DJ was hanging on, and he just DJ going birdie-less is
it's
so
odd.
Weird.
It's so odd. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for a guy that's on the streak of shooting in the 60s mm-hmm. since, I don't know, 1921 or something like that, and for him to, you know, be over par in the final round and just not make birdies, especially there when, the, you know, there's, the par fives are long, but other guys are taking advantage of them. So, yeah, you're right. That seems really odd.
You see his comment about his brother with the cast on his arm?
I missed that.
His brother fell down the stairs.
Oh, yes.
And he broke his arm. And he's like, those stairs will get you.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think then for a DJ? I mean, you know, Does that really jinx him for the Masters? I don't really think so.
No, he's still got to be the favorite. I think Tiger might be the betting favorite right now, but there's reasons behind that in Vegas.
Yeah.
But no, he's got to be the favorite. He can hit the ball both ways. His short game continues to get better. There's a great article I just read about how much work he puts in with his wedges and how that's turned his game into what it is and the player he is now. And easily could win. I think he's got to make another couple majors in him. As said, we talked about many times. If he's on his game, he is the favorite.
Yeah.
And he says that too. And that's just all.
Yeah, I think so. Even if he's, you know, if he's 8-1 like Tiger as he was last week, I didn't check the odds in the last couple days. But even if that's the case, I'd still make him the favorite over Tiger Woods for sure.
Oh, Tiger's. Don't bet. It's a terrible bet on Tiger.
I think everybody's just, you know, it's the Tiger bet.
It's the Vegas. Vegas yeah. needs to save themselves.
Yeah.
If he won, that would be the greatest story
ever. Sure, fantastic.
But, yeah, but I don't see it happening. Luke Donald.
Yeah.
Luke showed up.
Yeah, for part of it. that's actually a really cool story. I mean, for him to come back from, you know, a severe back injury where he had stem cell therapy to, you know, rebuild the disc in his back. And, you know, this is a guy who basically hadn't made a cut on the PGA Tour since, I think, last April. He's got a Canadian connection, too. His wife's from Montreal. I don't know why I keep putting all the Canadian connections in here, but I guess we pay attention to that a lot. But it was great to see him playing well. I don't know if his game can hold up on a lot of different golf courses just because he's not, you know, long enough. But, you know, this is a guy that was number one in the world. And, you know, to have him in the mix is not a bad thing for golf.
No, not at all. I love Luke's swing. Great short game. If you want to learn how to hit out of a bunker, find some videos of him. Find some of his teaching of that. He's easily the best bunker player of his generation, you could argue. I'm sure. Nice to see him back. Hopefully we can see more of him, and hopefully he gets back in the winner's circle, because you forget that he was the number one player in the world for over a year, almost a year.
Yeah, I mean,
a while.
Yeah, I mean, he had nine wins in a period of about a 4-year period. So, you know, those were worldwide wins, not just on the PGA Tour. So he definitely is a guy who can play. And, you know, even at 40, 41 years old now, you know, he's still got time to get a few more wins.
It's going to happen. You know who's going to drop in the world golf rankings?
Who's that?
Robert Garrigues.
Well, if you're not playing, it's pretty hard to gain points, right?
So for anyone not aware, Robert Garrigues became the first player to be suspended by the PGA Tour for, in quotes, drug abuse. And the drug he mentioned in a great, I believe it was a Twitter post or an Instagram post, was marijuana. I'll just read this quick quote. He said, "After a long period of sobriety, I had a relapse and subsequently failed a drug test for marijuana, a drug that, although legal in many states, is not permitted under the PGA Tour's anti-doping rules." We had a pretty good talk before we got started here about that. What's your take on this? This is obviously, marijuana is completely legal in Canada, as he mentioned, in some states it's probably going to be fully legal at one point, but there's not one professional sports league that's just been like, yeah, cool, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of different tentacles when you start talking about this. First of all, it's an Olympic sport, so they've got to adhere to WADA, which is the world, you know, the drug agency, as far as dealing with their policies are. I don't think this is an issue so much about, you know, a lot of people are obviously tweeting and saying, you know, it's the modern, it's 2019, it's a modern era, why is this an issue, and things like this. But, you know, unfortunately, those are the rules as you sign up for them, and you have to adhere to them. If you look through the player handbook, which is pretty thick when you go through it, you know, there's a code of conduct that they have to follow, and you know, that's just the way it is. is. And it's unfortunate that, you know, that he's had these issues. But the great part is, and I think you noted that as well, is that, you know, at least he was open about it right away. The PGA Tour obviously issued their statement, and then he, you know, came in right afterwards, took ownership of it. Didn't, you know, sit there and deny it or say it was an issue or whatever. And, you know, things might change as far as the tour is concerned. But to this point, you know what? They're trying to create a level playing field as well.
Well, one thing you mentioned when we were chatting, you said if you got a guy that's really anxious over putts and smoking weed chills him out, he now has an advantage that the other guy doesn't have.
Yeah, I think that's where I kind of look at it. I mean, I see it not only in this, but, you know, in alcohol use and things as well. If you look at a lot of major golf associations.
Well, look at Nick. He even said on the podcast, 5 beers, and he's way better than he was.
So much better.
Well, you know, there, you know, obviously there's people that have, you know, medically diagnosed anxiety issues, mm-hmm. and that's a different situation that might be. This might be in a particular thing from a performance standpoint where somebody doesn't play well, or, you know, they're anxious about playing golf because they want to score well or they're competing, and, you know, they use some sort of substance to alter that. And, you know, is that really fair? I don't really think as a competitor that I want to go in and have trained and done everything I could do to be skilled at what I'm doing and then have somebody, you know, artificially getting that, I guess, in some way. So I guess that would be the issue. Whatever the substance is, this is not really talking about, you know, whether one substance is better or legal or should be or anything. It's just more about fairness as far as competing.
As far as I know, there's no professional sport yet that's adopted to that legalization of marijuana.
No.
There are things about the CFL looking into it. I mean, they're in Canada. Let's be honest, the NHL, when was the last time a guy was suspended for drugs? They have the most lenient drug testing out there. This comes from many players that I know out in the National League, but there is nothing yet that's saying, like, you know,
yeah,
this is legal.
I think part of the problem always is an image thing, and mm-hmm. obviously they're protecting sponsors, and they're dealing with things from a perception standpoint, and that's the biggest issue for a lot of these, whether it's the PGA Tour. You know, they for years they never said why a player would get suspended, or they wouldn't, you know, really give out that information.
When did they change that?
I'm not sure the date,
because I was gonna say I saw a hilarious tweet that said something like it's pretty funny that none of the top players ever get caught.
Yeah, no, it was last year, because I can remember writing something about it and them just basically clarifying that they were going to be a little bit more open about what they were going to put out there. Again, it's not totally, you know, it's not totally out there, but again, they're trying to protect their brand more than anything. So really, yeah, it does come to value as far as brand, and that's across all professional sports
too.
Well, it could be, but I mean, they have to investigate, and a lot of people will sit there and argue that there's not performance enhancing benefits, but, you know, if WADA eliminates it, and obviously they eliminate, you know, lots of different items.
You can't even take like an inhaler with WADA.
Yeah, and there are a lot of different things, but people also have to understand a lot of those things are being done for other different reasons, because mm-hmm. they look at it one way, but they don't know what else it affects. And it's a really deep and complicated subject. It's really easy to just hop on Twitter and have a hot take about it, but all these things get really, really complicated really fast.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess when it comes down to it, you know, they're doing their testing. They are an Olympic sport. They have to adhere by certain rules. They're in their player handbook manual. I don't know how long the manual is now. I know last year's manual was about 176 pages. So they have a lot of things they have to adhere to as a player. And, you know, that's what you sign up for, right?
It's true. I mean, with the change of the rules, I could see a little bit of a difference. You might see some other names come out now, and they're probably being a lot more careful with what they're putting into their bodies. And yeah, well, that's not the toughest image I saw this weekend, though. Want to know what the toughest image I saw was? Patrick Reed, after going plus 10
yeah.
in the first 2 days, misses a cut. Word gets out that his wife calls up David Ledbetter and tells him he needs to get to the range at Innisbrook and fix this guy.
Yeah.
And he's not even his coach.
Well, you know what? He said, you know, I put full faith in her and, you know, whatever.
Because yeah, he'll go missing.
Whatever. He says that way. But it's definitely an odd situation. I mean, most guys are going to sit there, or most players, doesn't matter who it is, male, female, or whatever. You know, they're normally in control of their own destiny. They're going to say, you know what? I'm not playing well. I plus 10. I missed the cut. You know, it's time I see somebody. If my current coach is still in Texas and I'm here in Florida, maybe I'll, you know, talk to somebody who happens to be on the range. But yeah, it's kind of odd when all of a sudden, you know, it's his wife making a phone call and getting David Ledbetter of all people to come over. And
do you think he knew that she was doing that?
No, he said he didn't know. He said he admitted that, but he had full trust in her of doing that.
I'm going to release a statement when my wife calls a bar one time. I mean, send him home.
It's definitely odd. And I don't, you know, here he is heading into the Masters, going to defend.
That's what I was going to say. It's probably pressure that's on him at this point that he's not playing that well. He's got to be thinking about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other side. We don't know kind of what's been going on leading up to it. Maybe they've had conversations that he's thinking, oh, maybe I just need somebody to have a look, or, you know, geez, this is coming up and I don't want to look like a buffoon playing Augusta National, and, you know, I want to have a chance. So who knows what's said, but it just, you know, for those details to come out in the way they did, that just sort of made for an odd story for sure.
It was odd. And we actually talked about that with our guests this week. Who do we have this week, Scotty?
We've got Nick Starchuk, who is a 2013 Ontario PGA Teacher of the Year. He is a guy who's super passionate about golf.
Which I could not tell. Could not tell during that interview.
And you know what? He gave us a great interview talking a lot about teaching in general, as far as that industry, what it's all about, some of the relationships with the players, and we're looking forward to everyone hearing that now.
We're going to send it over to our interview with Nick Starchuk right about now.
What a welcome to the podcast, Nick Starchuk. Nick Starchuk is a highly acclaimed golf professional, well known for his students and his teaching. And Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
We want to talk to you today a lot about, you know, teaching as we head into the springtime. A lot of people are going to be taking golf lessons, and we want to broach on that topic a little bit, maybe some of the mistakes people make when they're trying to learn and get better. But first, why don't you give us a little bit of a thumbnail of your background for people who are not aware of you?
Sure. I'll try and do it quick. Born and raised in Ottawa, and after spending some time down at university in Kentucky, playing on NCAA scholarship, I moved to Toronto to work at Glen Abbey, and worked there for 4 years and kind of bounced around a little bit with some tour stuff, representing some technology a little bit, and spent 6 years at a private club, running the academy at a private club, which I'm proud to say was probably the biggest golf academy of any private club in the country. We had upwards of 500 people in the middle of in our programs. Like 35% of the membership was involved in it. So it was busy. I had the entire staff as busy as they've ever been. And since then, it's been 2 years where I branched out on my own. And, you know, I basically have created a bit of a niche market for myself of being known for the golf coach that can get that teenager a scholarship down to the States, or potentially the adult that, you know, wants to really make a big dent in his golf game. You know, I've always offered a 30% reduction in handicap in 3 months, or you can have your money back. So that's kind of my program. So I keep things small. I don't get to work with, you know, hundreds of people. I'm not doing clinics with a whole bunch of people where I walk a line. I do get deep and dirty into what's going on with someone's golf game, and we figure it out, whether it's, you know, on the practice green, whether it's, you know, sitting like a therapist in a chair, or we go out and play golf. So that's kind of what I do for my coaching business.
You mentioned you'll give a full refund if you can't get 30% off their handicap. Nick was nodding here, but I think you might have to give your money back on that one. I don't know.
Sign me up.
Sign up. Nick, at what point did you realize playing wasn't an option for you? Obviously played at a really high level at a Division I school. At what point did you realize teaching's more where I need to go in the golf industry?
Well, it's funny because when I was in university, you know, I was a little bit into the swing mechanics and stuff, but a little bit more for me. And I was in university saying, I am not going to be a golf teacher. That's the last thing that I want to do in my life. But then after I left university, I won a Division II national championship in 2000. And I joined MasterCard for 4 years as a fraud investigator. And I slowly realized that I'd get into work and pull up PGAtour.com and Golf WRX or whatever the forum of it was the day. And I'm looking at it going, like, I'm not really thinking about bank anymore. I'm thinking about trying to play golf. So I went off and I tried to do the Canadian Tour thing in 2003. And that's when I got into teaching, because I was pretty good at pinpointing where players needed to improve their game, where they needed to practice. And I was finding that I was helping more guys than helping myself. And if I made a dollar helping everybody that I worked with that was on the Canadian tour at the time, that was more than money that I was making playing golf. So that kind of gave me some insight into saying, you know what, it's time to get out of the bank and get the shirt and tie off and go and get a job in golf. So my home club, which was Kanata Golf Club at the time, they gave me a chance that summer to test the waters in teaching. And, you know, I ran junior camps and I taught a bunch of members. And I remember charging $25 an hour for a lesson. And I was doing four or five a day and it was pretty good. And then I realized that I could do it bigger by moving to Toronto. So I moved to Toronto like the day after I realized that was the thing to do.
So in Toronto, I know you ended up at Glen Abbey, and I know that was a big influence in your career, probably because, you know, you're a curious guy, and that was sort of something that was really a big part of that lifestyle, I guess, that was there and the group that was there. Why don't you explain a little bit of how that sort of piqued your curiosity in teaching and how it helped it blossom over the years that you were there?
Yeah, it gave me a big insight into golf. You know, it gave the guys that were there were thinkers, were critical thinkers. They were guys that, you know, always questioned why and loved to say, no, that's not right. So, you know, we've got guys, there were like Steve Chapman was there, who was one of the original Canadian Tour players, who's legendary, shot 58. Sean Foley, Connor O'Shea, Reg Millage. We had a lot of guys there that were good, like really good players. But really understood how to develop golfers. So we all kind of shared and helped out, even though it was somewhat of a shark tank where a guy would walk in the door and everybody would rush to him and say, I'll teach you. It was a little bit more of, you know, we really got to share and collaborate. And I think Sean Foley was the only guy that kind of did things on his own with his private lessons, but everything else was a joint venture with other people. So, It was really good to watch how other guys did it because they either taught a private lesson beside me or were working with the same group of players. So I got to get everybody's different flavor on how they did it. And, you know, I noticed things that I really liked. I noticed things that where I didn't want to go. And it really grew me as I grew as a communicator.
Now, that was a time when, you know, even then, that's, you know, just 15 years ago or so. But I mean, it's just still a time when teaching, I guess, sort of had a uniformity to it. There was a lot of things that just everybody did because that's what they were supposed to do. But within that group, I think you've told me before that you guys sort of, you know, questioned those things, got together, sort of said, hey, why is that right? And why is it not right? And then, you know, what's the truth of it all? I mean, is that something that you guys really explored?
We tried to. Out of the guys that were there, we read books and we watched the VHS videos that had been put out back in the day, and we tried to get as much information into us as we could so that, you know, if someone came to us with a certain move, we could kind of recognize, oh, that looks like a Jim Flick kind of a move. I remember what Jim teaches, and you go down that road. Or, oh, hey, like that's kind of the way that Led teaches, you know, we need to fix, you know, step number 10 from Ledbetter's 11 steps. And we could kind of jump into that. I mean, that's where I looked at it anyway, that I tried to read and understand everything so that I didn't have to put someone into a mold.
Speaking of Ledbetter, have you ever had somebody's wife call you and tell you need to come give their husband a lesson?
Isn't that weird?
That was the I tweeted out that Ledbetter's now missing since that leak too. That information leaked out. Justine terrifies me. But
yeah, it was just a very strange thing. I was down at the AP at the Arnold Palmer, a couple weeks, 3 weeks ago now, and I got to watch Patrick Reed on the driving range testing out. He was there with the GC quad rep, and he was there with the TrackMan guy. And he was looking to buy one. And after 10 shots, he asked the TrackMan guy to go away, that he was sold on the foresight. And Ledbetter was teaching, I forget the guy's name, right beside him. And they didn't even look at each other. There was no communication at all. And then a week later, they're together. And I'm thinking, how did this happen? Now, David is a wonderful guy. I've had a chance to ride around in a golf cart with him multiple times because I had a junior that played a lot of golf with David's son. So I got to pick his brain constantly. But, you know, I think that David, it might be putting Patrick into a bit of a model or a mold that might not really work for him. So I'm really intrigued to see how that relationship's going to work out. And I'm surprised that it wasn't the player that did it, that the guy's wife went to do it. That's just weird.
No, it looks like they did two sessions, and he said that, you know, he's still with Chris Kirk, who's his, you know, his regular coach going in there. But
yep.
You know, how would that work?
Wait, I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
So Justine goes, I don't know. Chris is out.
No. I mean, Chris is still in, yeah. But she just thought mm-hmm. he's close by. Led's, you know, close to Tampa or whatever. Bring him in. They had two sessions together, but you know, how does that work? If you're you know, if you're Chris Kirk, what are you thinking? What do you think of that, Nick?
I'm like, there's something in me that tells me that Chris was a former Ledbetter guy at one point.
Ah, okay. Mm.
So that there's a former relationship there. But what then gets me thinking is that the majority of guys that worked under someone back in the day, now they don't respect each other because they've left, right? So I'm not really sure how that relationship came about. And from Chris's perspective, I'm assuming that it's like, hey, you know, David is like, he started golf instruction. He was the first guy on the driving range as a golf coach before an event. And like, let's see what David has to say. And, you know, I've listened close in terms of, you know, what David's feedback is to what Patrick wants to do. So if it aligns with what Chris is thinking as well, I think it could work. But I know from my experience, you know, working with players who also have other coaches, it sometimes can get just a little bit contradictory because there's like egos involved and one coach doesn't want to admit that the other coach was right. So they almost want to say, well, you know, I'm not quite sure if that's the way it's going to work. Especially if that coach is a model or method teacher that's got their way and that wants everything to be the same way for everybody. So I hope that the two coaches can get along, and that it doesn't affect Patrick's view on, okay, guys, now which one of you is right because you're both saying each other's wrong? Like, do I now have to get rid of both of you?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a weird dynamic in golf when you bring in another me. You know what I mean?
For sure. Obviously, your relationship's going to be different with a tour player. Can you give a quick breakdown of what that's like, how you end up on the range 1 week? I actually read a great article in Golf Digest about how these guys get paid as well and the struggles mm-hmm. sometimes with that. What was your take on the relationship? You don't have to talk about the payment. I don't think you're going to go into that, though.
Well, I know there's a bunch of different ways of doing it. I know some guys, you know, ask for a retainer at the beginning of the year. They want their expenses paid and they get a percentage of certain placements on tour. You know, top five gets X percent, a win gets X percent, you know, similar to a caddy's arrangement. I've got friends out there that just say, no, I'm not taking a percentage of your winnings. I just want my hourly rate. When you want me, you pay my expenses to go wherever I want. And here's my hourly rate. So there's a bunch of different ways that the guys do it to get, you know, to get paid. But in terms of the actual relationship between the player and the coach, I think that the one thing is that the coach has to stand up for exactly what it is that they're saying, and they can't tippy toe and back down or just kind of beat around the bush when it comes to what it is they're trying to say. And
I'm
the
sure
best coaches out there.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. I'm sure egos get involved too. You're standing next to a guy that's making millions and millions of dollars per year. Probably takes a while to get used to that, to having the confidence to say, no, I'm right here.
Well, see, I've always taken the approach where, you know, you've kind of sought me out for my expertise, and I'd be doing you a disservice to not give you my full 100% opinion. So, you know, I down at the API, I worked with a great player who had an amazing players championship. And, you know, I had a chance to sit there and talk with him about his putting. And at one point I had to tell him, no, you don't need to know that, which was tough to do. But I knew that there was a chance that I'd never have the opportunity again. So here's my best foot forward. This is my best advice to you. If it contradicts something you say, let's talk it out. But there's a good chance that you're talking it based on your feel, and I'm giving you a real-world science example, and I could show you 50 tour players that do what you say isn't right, where that player could come back and say, well, this is what I feel, and my feel wins. So it's a give and take. It's a lot more cheerleading than it is golf teaching. So there's a lot of coaching involved, but you just have to find a way to get the player to understand it. So, you know, as an example, I watched my friend Jeff work with Patrick Rogers. And I'm like, so Jeff, what are you working on? He's like, oh, you know, he's got to get the center mass of the club behind the hand path, so the net force vector goes like this. And it was pure science.
That's Jeff Smith, of course, right?
Right. Patrick turns around and kind of looks at him and he's like, you know, caddy, put the club over there. Okay, make a backswing. Don't hit the club. Okay, you got it. That was it, right? And it was guide him through the right areas from feel that matched up with the look that accomplished the science and everybody wins. But I think that where it gets troubling is where the coach stands there and actually starts using words that the golfer doesn't get. Even if it's correct.
Yeah, I mean, communication is obviously a key, and also timing as well. I mean, you might be able to work through a lot of things from a technical basis in the off season where you're trying to prep the player and, you know, they're learning new things, but maybe the timing of that situation, the day before or during the week of a tournament is probably not so good, right?
Right. Like, I'd go through that type of conversation on Monday and if you weren't playing for the next 2 weeks, but that wouldn't be something you go through on a Tuesday or a Wednesday when they're going to peg it up on Thursday for some money. So it's a tough gig. It's a very tough relationship with to be able to do it and to be able to, it's one thing to be out there. It's another thing to stay out there. And I've always told guys that if you want to be a tour coach, the first thing you have to go do is be on tour. So you have to be there one day, make a good impression on probably the next week. And then the third week, the guy has to say, hey, are you going to be down in Austin? Are you going to Austin next week? And if you don't say yes, then they don't want you. So the guys that make it on tour are the ones who have committed to the tour life, right? Andy Plummer, Grant Waite, Sean Foley, Matt Killen, even Ledbetter doesn't travel very much. But, you know, if you looked at the guys that actually travel multiple weeks on tour, it's the same group of guys. So that's how they pick guys up. It's like, oh, I saw you teaching so-and-so for the past like 5 weeks. I noticed he played really well. Give me some of that secret sauce.
Do you think that's the trend though on tour? You know, that's how all of a sudden, you know, a guy ends up with a squad of players. That's really what it amounts to more than anything.
100%. Absolutely. Are you out there? Are you visible? And do you have one guy, you know, cheering about you? Did one tour player go back in the players' lounge and go, yeah, I'm hitting it really good, man. My coach got me into something. As soon as that's said, everyone in the room's like, who's the guy? Who's the guy?
Moving away from the tour life and the tour players, what are some mistakes you see at the amateur level that you also continue to see at the pro level?
Well, when it comes to how the pros work on it for more than 1 hour a week, you know, 1 hour a day for a week. So I think that the amateur player kind of doesn't evolve or develop as fast as they can simply because of the structure that we've accepted as lessons. As buy a 10 pack of lessons, that 10 1 hours, call me when you need me. I'd love to do those 10 hours in one day, you know? And that's where I find, like, that's my forte here in Toronto during the summer is to do a day school. I do it from 9 to 4. I'm hosting them at TPC Toronto this summer. And I get four guys and we hit golf balls and chip and putt all day. Now their hands are sore at the end of the day. They're exhausted, but I get an email from three of those guys at the end of the next week saying I shot my career low round and it was amazing. I learned more in that one day than I've learned in my whole life. Well, if you add up all the minutes that you've learned golf in your whole life and you slam them into one day, it's that you get so much accelerated learning. Whatever we do from 9 to 10, you've forgotten by 2 o'clock and you've moved on from it. So the idea that, you know, a golfer has to, they change their backswing and now they need, you know, 5 or 6 days of individual practice to make sure it sticks. It's not. I think it's a little bit more of, do you have constant supervision and constant effort to change it? So, you know, one of the benefits of a coach being at a private club is that you give John a lesson and then the next day John shows up to practice and he's right beside you. If John's not doing what we're doing, it's like, hold on a sec, Frank, I need to go tell John to fix this. John, blah, 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 run back over to Frank. And there, you know, he gets that constant coaching. There's always an arm around him every time he's going to hit balls. And that's why I saw so much massive improvement from everybody being at a private club, because they also can't tell me, oh, I practiced all week. It's like, really? I was here all week. Where were you? I didn't see you.
I mean, that commitment level, what's the threshold for that commitment level for it to actually make a difference, in your opinion? I mean, obviously, you've been coaching for a bunch of years, but, you know, where's the breaking point where a person goes from, you know, just dipping their toes into getting lessons to actually doing something that's meaningful?
It's just getting down to the whole commitment of what it is that they've got to do. Like, how much are they going to commit to their motion and commit to their game? And I find that most players that seek me out are coming from someone else that has done that. So the word of mouth is great, or they see what it is that I'm doing through, you know, all of my content. And they understand that, okay, I need to make a dent in my game. I can't hit a fair with my driver. I lose a dozen balls around. Nick, what's it going to take? And I say, well, the first thing we need to do is we need to hit golf balls all day. You know, all day. And, you know, most people balk at that. They're like, wow, you know, I don't know if I can take a whole day. And it's like, oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were serious. I guess I misunderstood.
If you asked me to hit golf balls all day, you would get a call from my wife.
Well, probably. But, you know, but you play golf, right? So it's an it's 30 minutes to drive to the club, 40 minutes of warm up, 4.5 hours of golf, 30 minutes for a beer, 30 minutes home. That's a day. So, you know, instead of going out and playing a round of golf on your Saturday, come hang out with me at a day school and really make a huge dent in what you're doing. We videotape everything so that by the time you go home, you know, and your wife's like, what'd you do today? Just hang around the golf course? Actually, let's put this USB stick in. You got 6 hours? Because we're going to watch what I did today. You know, so you, I send people home with a, with I call their golf Bible, that they're able to start creating a real package of what it is that they need to do with the before pictures, the after pictures, their own interpretation of what we're doing, and then my words on what we're doing on top of that. So they can't come back. And like the worst lessons I ever have to deal with are the guy comes back in a week later. I'm like, okay, so what did we work on last week? Oh, I forget. How could you forget? Like, I put you on Instagram. I sent you some videos at home. You know, I reminded you walking out the door, hey, what did we do today? You know, it's kind of like the kids when they go to school. Your kids comes home. What'd you learn today?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I don't want that. So I always have to make sure that if someone asks them what they did, that they're prepared with an answer, because that's what makes them remember. So it's the, I really believe that it's the long-term short period, kind of thing that really helps golfers get better and get a better understanding. I mean, it's the whole day gives me a chance to shape their concept, but it also gives me a chance to know who they are. And if they're really deep into it, they ask the questions, they do everything great. And if they're not really deep into it, you know, by 2 o'clock, they're like, hey, I'm really tired. I'm like, I'm going to have to go home. And then I get it. You know, then maybe that person isn't for me. Maybe that person needs to go back to their club and go talk to the pro inside the shop and say, hey, you know, can you give me a few lessons this year? But I look at those as tips. That's just a tip that might get you through the week, because no tip has ever lasted a lifetime.
Have you ever, you mentioned maybe you're not for me there to a player. Have you ever had to fire a player and let them go and just say, this isn't going to continue to work?
Do you really want to go down that road?
Yes.
So that's a yes.
Absolutely have I.
Yeah.
Now, at a private club, I had to bite my tongue and accept it every single time. I fired nobody when I was at a private club because I'm service, right? I can't say no. But since leaving there, yes, I can name four people right off the bat that I'm happy that I'm not working with anymore.
Name them.
Because I do this because I love it. I don't need your money. I've got a list of people that are going to replace you when it comes to the money side of things. But, you know, if you're not going to listen to me and you're going to argue, well, Jordan Spieth doesn't do that, then what are we doing here?
Yeah.
Like, so I have no problem with that. And there are some of the players that I've let go. One pro, for example, but, you know, really good players that are going to do big things, that have already done big things, whether with me or since they've left me. I don't want to finish my awesome day of my kick-ass job to go home and sit down on the couch with my wife. And she's like, what's wrong with you, man? I could kill that person. Like, that's not fun. So yes, I have had to let people go. I don't usually, like, sometimes I'll have the conversation with them or with them and their parents. You know, sometimes it is the parent that's the reason. but sometimes I just kind of say, you know, hey, like, you know, maybe this isn't working. Why don't you take some time to think about it and, you know, give me a shout when you're ready. And we just kind of don't talk anymore. I don't want to say that all the time that I do this, but I don't really feel it's my place all the time to sit someone down and say, you're not doing this, and point the finger like, you know, an old school grade one teacher would do. That's not what I do. I give them the option. I say, look, if this is something that you want from me, and either you or your parents are paying a lot of money to be with me for this often, like, we've got to be cool. If you're here 3 or 4 hours a week, we've got to have a cool relationship, and it's got to be fun. And you have to feel like you're doing something that's working for you. But if every time I ask you to do something, you bring up an example of a tour player that's not doing it, you're looking to prove me wrong. And that's the wrong situation to be in. And it's been refreshing to be able to have the opportunity to do that.
Do you have anything you're passionate about?
Golf.
I'm fired up here.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I have, it's not just golf instruction. It's the golf business in general. It's the, you know, I call it the golf public, which is, you know, all my buddies' view of golf. And I just love it. I mean, I'm a part owner in a software company called ProShop Partner, which does club and event management, because I believe that there's more engagement and there's more fun to be had in a golf tournament. So for example, you know, we put 90 iPads in the golf carts at Glen Abbey so that when you played men's night, you knew who ace number 7 or who's low gross after 9, and all the scores were in at the end of the day. So by the time you finished up your round, you knew where you stood. You got your envelope with your gift certificates or whatever it was. Like, the whole experience changed. And that's what I'm really about in golf, is that I want to provide an experience to the golfer. My vehicle at the moment is instruction, but I'm hoping down the road my vehicle becomes something more of a leadership management position at a club, where I can influence this kind of stuff on the younger generation and actually provide mentorship to improve member engagement and experience, because I believe that's seriously missing nowadays.
So when we're talking about Joe and Joe Public here, as far as golfers and their experience going out to play and learn about the game and to get better, I mean, where are they making mistakes? Where should they be starting if they really want to get better, in your opinion?
Well, the first thing, they have to actually seek out a golf teacher, and not all pros are the same. I mean, I know pros that don't know how to teach. I know pros that spend 40 or 50 hours a week in a pro shop and teach on the side. And then I know guys that do nothing but teach. And if you're going to be an expert at something, you have to dedicate everything you've got to it. So if there's that 10,000 hour rule, I've blasted through that in the practical lessons, but I've also blasted through that in the reading and the research and the education side of things. So the trouble that I think that Joe golfer has is that they don't know the difference. And a club's not going to really identify the difference, because they want everybody to do the lesson, which I think is a disservice to Joe golfer. So, you know, if I could have a magic wand, I'd put a big billboard up on the 401 or in the QEW here in Toronto and say, you know, find out where your golf pro learned from, or where your golf teacher learned from. Ask for their pedigree, ask for their resume, because, you know, there's lots of guys, like I said, that work 60 hours a week in a shop and do 2 lessons a week. But, you know, if you check their Instagram profile, they're performance coaches. Yeah. They've never played at a high level. They've never got a great golf lesson, let alone taught a great golf lesson. But since there's no, I don't even know if the word's reform or, you know, like bringing it all in together, there's no one out there that's going door to door to saying, okay, like, are your teachers doing the right thing to support Joe golfer? They're not. So I honestly ask everybody that I can that's in golf or outside of golf, if you're going to take a lesson, research a person to take lessons from, just like you would do if you needed knee surgery. You're not going to go to your dentist, right? They're a doctor. You're not going to go to your chiro. They're a doctor. But you actually have to go and search out the people that specialize in golf teaching and coaching. And they're so few and far between.
I mean, that said, you know, they need some responsibility besides that as well. I mean, they have to put the dedication that's in there. Mm-hmm. What should they be doing themselves besides, you know, finding the right person?
Well, I think that they should be reading a bunch. They should be, you know, going and spending time with other golf instructors. They should be shadowing the guys that they know are the better teachers. I think that, you know, that's the first way to do it. I think that, you know, when it comes to mentoring the young guys, I think that the mentors are no longer the head pros. The mentors are the teaching pros. So you have to go search those guys out. I know lots of guys in pro shops that have gone to their head pro and say, hey, I'd like to teach more. And the head pro goes, well, I don't make money off your teaching, but I make money off you selling these shirts. So, you know, back in the day, the head pro was responsible for teaching you how to teach, teaching you how to change grips, hey, teaching you how to build a golf club. But those things are all past, because, you know, golf pros mostly at clubs are, you know, they're behind the desk or they're merchandisers. It's not all the same anymore. So I recommend guys going out to those that they know that hold golf schools or that are the real developers or are national coaches. These are guys to go follow and listen to and ask the questions like, hey, who should I go see next, or what should I do next? I've got a list of things that I give to my guys in my mentoring program on what books to read, who to study from, what websites to go to, and, you know, guys to go and shadow. And I make sure that they find all the local guys first before they get on an airplane. But if the idea is to get on an airplane, hey, I'm going down to Orlando, great. Go see Sean, go see Brian Mogg, go see Mark Sweeney with Aimpoint. There's lots of guys there that you can go and learn from. And I think that today is the day of the certification. Everybody's certified in something. Go get certifications. You know, don't base your whole life around being, well, I'm TPI, so that's all I do. Go get them all and figure out who it is you want to be as a golf teacher. Because the more time I spend with these guys, whether the bigger name teachers than me, I learn all kinds of stuff by what I should do. But then I kind of realize the stuff that, you know, I don't fully 100% agree with the way they do it. And that's my point, that's my time to go move on to somebody else. So I honestly think that the best way that a teacher and an instructor or instructor can get better at their craft is to go watch the experts in their craft. And again, just like Joe Golfer, they have to go seek those people out.
And I mean, obviously, if those Joe Golfer, Jill Golfer is going to find those people, they got to put the time in as well, right? Or have no expectation to get better.
Well, if you're not going to put the time in to find the right guy, are you going to put the time in to actually do the lesson and do the drills and go to the driving range like the practice plan says? I mean, so I mentioned earlier that, you know, I can drop 30% of your handicap in 3 months, but I give you a practice plan and trust me, I follow up, right? If I haven't heard from you in 3 days, hey, how's your practice plan going? You know, what have you done? And if they say, well, I didn't get a chance to do it, then okay, well, let's just hope that you don't stall. But I keep feedback on all that. So at the end of the 3 months, if they only drop one shot or they go up a shot, I get something that I can then review and say, well, let's go back and see how well you did along the plan that I made. And it's not that the plan was wrong, because there's no way you could prove a plan wrong if you didn't do the plan.
You got to do the work. You got to do the work. Well, thanks, Nick. How do people find you on social? I know you're pretty active, but obviously if people haven't checked you out yet, where can they find you?
Best place is at Nick Starchuk. That's Starchuk on Instagram. Probably my best resource for what it is that I'm doing. My website, Nick Starchuk Golf. Over the next little while, you'll see me, you know, posting a whole bunch of new content in terms of how I work with players, but I'm also representing a new putting technology called Capto. So I plan on delivering a whole bunch of new content with regards to basically shaking up the world on the should-be's in putting.
Awesome. Well,
lots of new stuff coming.
I know you've got a lot of content that is coming, like you said. I know we've talked about a few things and I've heard a few other things on a couple other podcasts, but I appreciate you sharing that with us today. So people, go check him out. That's Nick Starchuk. He was the 2013 PGA of Ontario Teacher of the Year. Really appreciate you coming on, Nick, and looking forward to seeing more of your stuff this year.
Terrific. Thanks. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate it, guys.
All right. Thanks, Nick. We really appreciate that. You're certainly passionate about teaching, and we really appreciate that. I think you're about to go get a lesson,
oh,
aren't
yeah.
you?
I just can't find a teacher. I don't know. No.
Maybe across the table and jump into the backyard here right now.
I was fired up after that. As we've talked about, I'm under the weather, and that definitely brought me back to life. I'm 100%. I'm ready, Scotty. Let's get in. Let's get into the range. If that doesn't fire you up to find your local PGA professional, nothing will, because that guy is so passionate about golf.
Yeah, it's a great part of his story and a great part of his success. And if you talk to his students, they really, you know, they dig that vibe, that the fact that he's, you know, that excited about the game and gets them excited about it too. But another reason people might get excited this year is the Canadian Open. And the Canadian Open announced this week that Rory McIlroy is going to be coming to play.
He's a guy, right? He plays out on tour.
Yeah, I've heard of him. He's sort of okay, eh?
Yeah, he's decent.
What did you think of that news?
That fired me up, because we're planning on being there for the 4 days. They also announced a pretty awesome concert. Yeah. Glorious Sons and Florida Georgia Line, two bands that you'll never see on another bill together, but they are playing the Canadian Open together. That's going to be quite the difference.
Not quite together. They're on opposite nights. They're different nights, but still, you know, back-to-back is still pretty good to see, that's for sure.
We'll be there for sure, front row. I'm stoked about Rory being there. It's at Hamilton Golf and Country Club. I don't know the course. Where do you see stack up there on that golf course?
You know, it's a fabulous Harry Colt old school golf course. The only downside, will be the fact it cannot hold as many people as, say, Glen Abbey can. So I can tell you right now that the tickets that just went on sale, they're going to be pretty dear for Saturday and Sunday rounds for people that are, you know, going to chase Rory McIlroy. So if people want to get there, they're going to make sure that they get those tickets soon. Otherwise, it could sell out, whereas Glen Abbey, they can have as many people as they want in there.
Yeah, I'm just sick of Glen Abbey. I think that's, you know, everyone's kind of the same way. It's so easy for those guys. They go out and shoot minus 25 to win or something ridiculous. So to see Hamilton, which anybody that's played it has said it's an amazing golf course. I'm hoping we can get out at some point before so we can give a quick breakdown and understand the course a little bit better going into the Canadian Open. But are we ever going to play in Canada right now? It's like if I woke up, there's more snow in my backyard. My dog loves it, but this is terrible.
Yeah, we're finally starting to see some opening dates and some courses open, but they're mostly down in southwestern Ontario. Seeing courses open in Windsor area now, London area. Just today, I finally saw some opening dates for some courses in Ajax, west side of Toronto. So there's hope. There's some hope.
I can't wait. I'm ready to get out there. Talking about golf all winter just makes you want to get fired up and go play. I've played a few virtual rounds. You play every Sunday. How's your game going into the season?
I'm working hard on it. I actually played Copperhead. We played that on Sunday.
You have played the course. You lied.
I guess, yeah, virtually. But you know what? I'm just like every other golfer. I'm trying to get better. I might be 49, but I'm still trying to work on my game.
You don't look it.
Thanks.
You look at least 55.
Thanks. Appreciate that. But you know what? Working with students really gets me excited to work on my game as well. So I'm working with some of the different tools that I have to make use of, 4D motion capture, where I'm trying to work on some different things with, you know, this will bore you to death.
No, I'm ready. I want to do it myself.
Wrist angles and different things. But, you know, it does get me excited then to get outside and start to see ball flight. And I know, you know, some of my students are anxious too to get out there and see the differences that they've been working on over the winter. I mean, you can look at a screen all winter and see certain things that are there, and it's way better than it used to be. But nothing is a substitute for getting outside and actually playing golf on grass.
I'm heading up to Ottawa this week, and I'm going to hit Kevin Hames' range and see some balls. That first couple ball flights that you see actually in person outside,
magical.
There's nothing different. It's so awesome. So I'm really excited for that. And Nick and I got to get our games in line because we got a tournament that we talked about last week. We got the Flagstick Open just, you know, over a month and a half away.
Yeah, hard to believe. I mean, coming up here in the May long weekend at Equinel in Kempville. We talked a little bit about it on the last week's podcast, but the field's starting to fill up.
It is.
Yeah, we're starting to see inquiries from players all over the place, not only in Canada, from the States as well, and for $199. I think the swag, I talked about it before on the other show, but we actually have another edition. I can't fully announce it yet.
You want to give a hint? Are we talking shoes?
No.
We're talking Scott McLeod signed photos.
Oh God, people would throw those out, wouldn't they? But it is something that's cool and custom and something we haven't had at any of our tournaments before. So hopefully that gets all ready to go. And yeah, people will really love the swag that they get. They get two rounds of golf, they get a dinner, prizes, over $350 worth of swag before they even tee off. So if people want to check that out at flagstickopen.com, they can certainly do that. And I know you guys are getting close to getting signed up, right?
Oh, we're coming.
Yeah, I've done it.
There you go.
We're on our way. Do you need a band for Saturday night? Nick and I's old band could.
Hey, well, we can talk about that.
Yeah,
really?
They want to hear some nice soft pop rock.
Was that your forte back in the day?
Oh yeah.
Oh man.
How's it going, Equinel?
Oh boy. Oh boy. Oh boy.
I hope you're all ready.
It did not go well.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. That's why you guys are on the podcast.
Yeah,
right?
Why we're not playing music anymore. Right there. This is a great time to wrap it up. As we said, sign up for the Flagstick Open at flagstickopen.com. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast. Rate it 5 stars, right, Nick?
That's it.
5 stars only, as Nick always says, but he didn't write there. Everyone have a great day. Whenever you're listening to this, we're going to be hitting golf balls soon. And remember, folks, if your wife calls your teacher, you're probably going to miss the cut. Have a good one.